Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities, all you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey. Not in a creepy
way. Welcome. This is Eric.
This is brother Jay.
And tonight, on our last episode of Clocktober, we're going to talk about the movie Looper 2012. Written and directed by Rian Johnson, director and writer of The Last Jedi, and director of Brick, also a JGL movie. So, Brother Jay, was this on your list?
No.
I think this is actually on Drew's list.
Probably.
Yeah, it's on my list. I thought I liked it just fine.
I've never seen this movie before the night before last.
Oh, fantastic. So, you've mentioned before that sometimes you have problems with time travel movies and suspending disbelief. Is that right?
Sometimes. Sometimes I get bogged down in the minutiae and the quibbling over timelines and such. So, yes, sometimes, occasionally, depending on the movie and depending on how up their own ass they are about yada-yadaing the whole time travel thing.
For instance, Primer, you didn't like.
No, I didn't like Primer.
Because it was too up its own ass.
This, that would be correct.
Okay. So what did you think of your first viewing of Looper?
I thought this was a fine movie. I mean, it wasn't the greatest movie I've ever seen. Plot-wise, it was okay-ish. It was a pretty movie. It was certainly had a lot of, it had a good aesthetic, and it was decently acted, although, you know. And had some good casting. But, you know, it wasn't the best movie I've seen, but, it wasn't bad. I
had forgotten that Emily Blunt was in the movie. I'd been on an Emily Blunt tear this month.
I didn't realize it was Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
Yeah. They did some prosthetics.
Yeah. The movie was all largely practical effects as well.
Yep.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, what did you think of their conceit on the time travel?
What are you asking, really?
Okay, well, here's the way this movie works. So let's just dive into the plot a little bit. Then we'll get into how they try to resolve paradoxes. What we know is that in the year 2044, the United States has suffered economic collapse, causing severe social decay and growth in organized crime. In addition, a strange mutation has occurred in 10% of the population, giving them minor telekinetic powers, manifested by their ability to float small objects, like quarters. Those people are referred to as TKs. 30 years in the future, 2074, time travel is invented, but it's immediately outlawed. However, by that point, tracking technology has rendered it nearly impossible to dispose of bodies secretly. So crime bosses time travel to send their targets to the past to be killed by loopers. Hired guns paid in silver to kill whoever sends to them. The victims have bags over their heads and silver bars strapped to their backs. This comes at a price. The severe sanctions on time travel mean that crime bosses eventually need to end the looper's contract and also eliminate all traces of their work relationship. So they send his older version back to be killed by the younger version, therefore closing the loop. They're paid in gold for this to live the rest of their life in comfort, or for the next 30 years in comfort. Because once your loop is closed, you're out of your contract, you got lots of money, but you know that your life is finite at that point.
The clock is ticking, as it were.
So, the idea of that, there, you know, of course, one of the fundamental time travel paradoxes is the grandfather paradox. which is the you can't theoretically go back in time to kill your own grandfather, because if you did, you wouldn't be born, therefore you couldn't kill your grandfather, therefore you would, you know. So, but Rian Johnson said that part of the creative decision was to take this linear approach to time, so that there's a constant switch to alternate timelines. That means that time is dealt with on a moment-to-moment basis. So, like, nothing happens until it happens. So any changes made to the timeline don't go retroactive. They only go forward. This is why there's some fun things with the young version maiming themselves to send messages to the old version. Because if it had changed the original timeline, then that scar would be on the arm forever. But this way, a new scar develops that you hadn't seen before. Now, this is maybe tap dancing around it, but basically, there's a lot of... I think Bruce Willis does a good job when he's asked about how time travel works. He says something about, like, I can't really explain it to you. I could nap it out with some straws on this table, but I'm not going to. Just take it for that it works.
They actually had a deleted scene that explained it pretty well.
Oh, did they? I did not see the deleted scene. And does it explain this part of it?
Yeah, I'm gonna describe a visual, which, you know, works out astoundingly well. But since we're an audio medium, I'll do my best.
No, theater of the mind. Envision yourself.
So he took two straws and put them about, about 8 inches apart, parallel on the table. And then he took the salt shaker and he poured the salt really heavily on one side, and then it kind of faded towards the other side, so that as you got closer to one straw or away from the first straw, the number of grains of salt diminished and diminished and diminished until there was none on one side and they were all on the other side. So it was like this gradient of salt.
Between the two straws?
Right. So he was describing that that's how his memories were working, is that, you know, they weren't, the closer he got to the past with the memory, the clearer it got.
So that's why he couldn't remember.
He was beginning to forget things from the future.
From the recent, his future. His old future.
Yes. So then the longer he was away from it, the more he was less able to remember it, which is why he said he didn't remember things in the present where he was until it happened. And then he had crystal clarity, even if he wasn't there.
And so we have this conceit that most of this movie takes place in 2044, even though that's where young Joe lives. Young Joe is Joseph Simmons, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and he's supposed to be 25 years old, and he works for a mafia company in Kansas City as a looper. His boss, Abe, is Jeff Daniels, who I love. I just love Jeff Daniels.
Yeah, he did a good job. There was lots of good casting in this movie.
Yeah. Abe actually owns a club that Joe hangs out at and spend times with a showgirl named Susie, played by Piper Perabo. And Abe also controls the Gat Men, his muscle, led by Kid Blue, played by Noah Sagan. And the Gat Men are known for such because they have these long-barreled Magnum revolvers, which are actually real guns, but they also weigh like 5 or 6 pounds. And the Loopers have this blunderbuss that's basically like some sort of electric shotgun. So young Joe, he has a sense of fashion, but his fashion is for the 1990s. So he or late century, late 20th century fashion. So he wears ties, which are seen as ridiculous. He wears these like 80s clothes. He drives a Mazda Miata. So he has that whole affect going on. So Joe's got a goofy friend who's also a looper named Seth, who's Paul Dano, who we know and love for getting his milkshake drunk.
That's right.
And Seth comes to Joe and says, Joe, I've got a problem. I have a hide because I made a mistake. When the last contract came in, he was supposed to just shoot him. Basically, they appear at a designated spot at a designated time, and instantly, as soon as they appear, the looper shoots them. And they've got a bag over their head, so there's no feelings about the whole thing. The only way they know their loop has been closed is when they turn them over, and instead of silver, it's gold. Well, unfortunately for Seth, when Seth's target comes over, he starts whistling a song that Seth remembers from his childhood. So now he knows it's him. And he can't shoot him. And the guy runs away. And now Seth is truly fucked because he has not completed his contract and the Gap guys will be after him. And he shows up at Joe's door and begs for Joe to hide him. And Joe doesn't really necessarily want to hide him. But, I don't know, much like Sam from Casablanca, he does the right thing. And he lets Seth hide out in his cellar, his little like wine cellar thing.
Well, his silver vault.
Yeah, his hidden room where he's kept half of his silver.
Yeah, because it's not really a cellar because he's not on the bottom floor.
So, yeah, he's got this like secret room under his floor where he keeps his silver stash.
Because he's ostensibly skimming silver.
Yes.
Keeping half of what he's actually collecting when he's not supposed to.
Yeah. And
is odd considering that they're killing on a contract. So wouldn't the money be anyway? That was one of those things. I'm like, well, if they're killing on contract, why wouldn't it be all theirs? Why would they be giving any money?
Isn't he bringing it back in exchange for something at Abe's? Like, didn't they give him some sort of like regular currency for it?
Nah, I don't know.
I think so. I think he's exchanging the silver for something else, but most people bring back four. He brings back two. And Abe actually reveals later that he knows this has been going on. Like, minor level skimming isn't really a concern to Abe, as long as Joe fulfills his contract. So, the Gat men show up at Joe's apartment. Not the one with the roaches. And Joe goes with them to meet Abe. And Joe is super smooth. Joe is a young Bruce Willis. That's what he's trying to be. And I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt actually did a good job with that.
Yeah, and the some of the added extra features, he took great pride in that. At one point, Bruce Willis actually told him, he said, wow, you sounded just like me. And he said, you know, he's playing it off as cool. He's like, oh, that's cool, man. But in the background, he was like, fuck yeah! I was trying to do my Drew imitation, but...
I'm going to resist making a pointy shoes joke. So, basically, Abe, like, Joe thinks he's cool. No, Abe is the coolest. Abe just tells it like it is.
Yeah.
Like, you're going to give up your friend. You can do it the easy way or the hard way, but you're going to give up your friend. So, he offers, Joe a way out. He says, you don't have to give up your friend. You just have to give up half of your stash.
Well, and here's the thing. Abe's from the future, so doesn't he really already know what's going to happen? Ostensibly.
Ostensibly, yes. Well, he doesn't know the history of everything.
Well, but here's the thing. So, he should know, except that, according to Bruce Willis, he wouldn't remember until it happens.
Okay.
That's how they get around all the time travel minutia.
Oh, and by the way, Joe is taking French because he's going to retire to France. What's funny is that they were going to shoot in Paris, but they didn't have the money. And the distribution company in China said, oh, well, you can come over and shoot for free in Shanghai. So that's why they did the Chinese stuff. And that's why they kind of incorporated the learn Mandarin. Come on.
Well, that's surprising because the movie budget was $30 million, so...
Well, apparently going to France would up that too much. So
yeah, I suppose.
And this made a decent amount of money.
It made like $170 million.
Yeah, so it was fine.
It definitely made back more than the budget.
Sure. And, you know, the plot does not lend itself to Looper 2. Although the world you could continue to inhabit, right?
You could. I mean, with time travel, you can do lots of things. That's the thing.
Well, sure. Yeah. So, old Seth is, by the way, still in the past because he wasn't killed by Seth. So, old Seth, we see him trying to climb a barbed wire fence to get across country and escape. But then he notices scars on his arm that are just appearing, and they're telling him to go to an address. And at first he ignores this, and then his fingers start disappearing. And I thought this was like basically the coolest conceit of this whole show.
He was being Back to the Futured.
Yes. Well, he's also, I mean, the young version of Seth was being dismembered to inspire the old version to show up, which he does. They even cut off the tip of his nose, which I thought was sort of gruesome and also kind of cool. Again, I like that whole conceit. Because, yes, he was trying to run away, and they're he's losing a limb, like, every step. So, it's very sad. Actually, it turns out they were keeping young Seth, like, on a ventilator as they were cutting him apart. Because I guess if they killed him, would that mean that old Seth would get to run around free? I don't know how that would work, but...
No, if they'd killed him, he would disappear. He would no longer exist.
So, did they want the money he had with him, or why did they want him to return?
I don't... There was plenty in this movie that didn't make sense, so... And that was one of the things that I wasn't able to suss out, so...
So, Joe continues to do his killings, and he continues to go to this diner after each killing, where he's served by a waitress named Beatrix, and he's waiting to do one of his killings, and the victim is late. And when the victim appears, he has no bag over his head, and it's old Joe, Bruce Willis. And as he tries to shoot him, the old Joe turns around, and so therefore all the projectiles end up going into the gold, or being deflected by the gold that he has on his back. And then he grabs the gold bars and just throws it at young Joe, and then clocks him unconscious. When young Joe comes to, he finds a note telling him to get out of town. But instead, Joe goes to his apartment, where he finds the Gap Man searching it and removing his silver. So he traps Kid Blue in the floor safe, and he gets shot by another gang man, falls from the fire escape, and blacks out. And then, is this like... trying to sew up the timeline from old Joe's perspective at this point? Because this would effectively kill... Well, this wouldn't... It would kill Joe's loop, right? If he had died from the fall? I guess he wouldn't have died from the fall. What...
If he had died from the fall, there would have been... Right. There would have been no future.
Okay. So...
He couldn't have come back from the future because he wouldn't have lived.
But this is the story where we get to see Joe's complete future from young Joe to old Joe.
One possibility, because that's what Bruce Willis explains, is that the future isn't the future yet. So it actually can be changed, which is the whole point of him coming back.
Well, true. Yes.
So the future that he remembers or is trying to remember, he is trying to change to a different outcome if he can. The struggle that he has throughout the movies, he doesn't quite remember exactly how it should be. So he's kind of stumbling through a bunch of things.
And young Joe pretty much just wants to kill old Joe. Old Joe is a liability to young Joe.
Well, not only that, he thinks he's wrong.
Well, yeah. So we see a version of history where Joe continues his life of crime and his continued drug use, and ends up eventually going to Shanghai, where he meets this beautiful woman who helps him recover from his drug addiction, and they fall in love, and they can't have kids, but they're still having a good time. But then 30 years rolls around, and they show up at his house to close his loop. And during the process, they kill his wife, the love of his life, on the orders of the mysterious guy called the Rainmaker.
The Fresh Maker.
Yeah. He is closing all the loops. Which is why there's a lot of loops being closed during the time we see young Joe, before he ends up with his own loop to be closed. So, we go all the way up to this time, and we see how Bruce Willis goes back to the future, and buys all the first aid supplies. And then we catch up to the present, and where Joe sees young Joe fall off the balcony, rescues him. And then we have old Joe looking up some numbers at the library, and the letters be able to form on his hand that spell out Beatrix, because young Joe wants old Joe to come meet with them. So they meet at the diner, and they order the same meals.
Well, Bruce Willis orders the meal for both of them.
Well, yeah. And old Joe asks young Joe how his French lessons are going, and then says in French, "I know you have a gun under the table pointed at me." And young Joe doesn't understand what old Joe says, and old Joe's like, "Oh, it's okay. You don't get that. You will." So then we talk about the Rainmaker, about how he's controlled all the crime syndicates, he's closing all the loops, and that the syndicate men killed old Joe's wife. And so old Dale, one of Joe's looper colleagues, gives old Joe the sequence that hints at the identity of the Rainmaker. So with old Joe back in the past, he can look up the Rainmaker as a child. Remember last week when we were talking about killing Hitler as a baby?
Yeah, as I was watching this movie, I'm like, hey, you bastard.
I didn't remember this was coming. So
now, like, subconsciously, you did, clearly.
You know who doesn't initially have a problem killing a child?
Old Joe.
I mean, it takes an emotional toll, but he'll get over it.
Well, it scars him so much he moves on to the next kid.
Well, exactly. Yeah, he's got... there are three possible children who are the Rainmaker based on the hospital and the date of birth.
Yeah.
Well, he full-on kills the first one. He's a baby killer in this movie.
Yeah. Well, it's not a... He luckily... I mean, not luckily, but he wasn't a baby. He was a kid. I mean, he was a...
He's a toddler killer.
He wasn't a toddler.
I guess you're right. He's a child. A pre-adolescent. He's a child.
Yes.
Yeah, what, is she supposed to be like 10? Something like that?
He's a latchkey kid.
Yeah, I think he's less than 10, though. He's got to be like...
I would have pegged him at like 7 or 8. Yeah. It doesn't matter. It doesn't diminish that he's a child killer.
Oh, yeah. You know, absolutely. He's a child killer. 100%.
Yeah.
Wants to be a multiple child killer.
Yeah. It was actually... That was the most jarring, difficult part of this movie that took me out of the movie. Because it just... Boyfriend Jesse actually said, it was like, what the fuck?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like, yeah, no, I'm with you.
Did you tell Jesse about Hitler?
we actually had a Hitler discussion. So, because we had discussed on the pod that, you know, I wouldn't have killed baby Hitler, but I would have done something to make sure that he had never been conceived. So,
yeah. Well, old Joe doesn't have that opportunity because he's... Because Hitler is already a child at this point.
Yeah.
So, young Joe, during the struggle with old Joe, comes up with part of this map. So, he goes to the coordinates of a farmhouse where one of these kids live. And he's going to basically just wait out and wait for old Joe to show up. And then kill him. And then life is good. Unfortunately, the lady who owns the farmhouse, Sarah, played by Emily Blunt, lives there with her child, Sid, played by Pierce Gagnon. She is, somewhat protective of her land.
You could say that. This also reminded me of Signs.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. And she is taking no shit, theoretically. Although Joe kind of calls her bluff and does his best Bruce Willis impression. But then she looks at the map and sees her son's birthday and a hospital code on it. And then she's like, oh, no. And so she shoots him.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's full of salt.
Yeah.
But still, it's unpleasant.
Oh, yeah. No, it'll fuck you up.
Yeah. So we have a little Signs going on. And then we have a little bit of Damien from The Omen.
Yeah, we do.
Because Sid is a serious little kid, and Sid has some anger management issues.
Yeah, he really cashed in on the TK lottery.
Oh yeah, and also he's the kid. He's just, I mean, the acting I thought was pretty great, kid acting, because he comes off as creepy anyway. Like,
yeah,
sort of creepy smart, like sees through the bullshit.
Yeah, he's like Rain Man savantish, you know, because he knows everything. To a degree. I mean, he's ultra prescient, ultra aware, and ultra intelligent, but also he's a kid, and as such, you know, because boyfriend Jesse was like, man, that kid's out of control. I'm like, he's a kid. And then that's what a kid would be like. I mean, having tantrums and not being able to control them, you know, that's part of growing up. So
actually, per the notes here, he's supposed to be 5 years old.
Oh.
So still, 5 years old, kindergarten.
All right.
He's about right, but he's a smart 5 year old. He's like some sort of prodigy. And like, I like when they have the argument doing the math game where he's stubborn.
Yes.
And I know children who are that stubborn. I may have been raising one for the last 9 years.
And you may have been an older brother to one or two, so.
Yes. Yes, perhaps, yes. Yes, certainly present company, I think. You were a strong-willed child who grew up to be a strong-willed adult.
Yeah, I was going to say, not much has changed.
No, not really.
Yeah.
Yeah. Had you been able to levitate people and make them explode, making blood rain?
Oh, it would have happened.
Oh, absolutely. It would have happened to me.
There would have been a path of destruction wide and far. Yeah, no. It would be like scorched earth most of North America, I suspect. Yeah, so, that little cornfield or no, cane field, sugar cane field, that had nothing on me.
Oh, absolutely not. No. So the idea is that old Joe is going to kill the Rainmaker, which is supposed to change the timeline enough that he never gets to loop back, so therefore he meets his wife and he stays in that time. What he expects is he's going to kill one of these children and then, boom, be back with his wife. Of course, he goes and kills the first five-year-old. And since he doesn't disappear, he realizes, oh, I just killed the five-year-old for nothing.
Yeah. And then they have that freaky scene where the kid hand wakes him up. Like the over his mouth. Yes. That scared the shit out of me.
Oh, yeah. There's some good work in this movie.
There's some creepy stuff. Yeah, no, I give the movie credit. There's some really good stuff that startled me. This movie, actually, I was not able to guess. I was not able to get too far ahead of the plot, which was pleasing.
Yeah, normally, no, me too. So they're getting ready for, and of course, Sarah and young Joe are getting closer. And Sid and Joe are getting closer. And Sid thinks that Sarah's sister is the real mother and Sarah is not her mother, so Sarah is a liar.
Not his mother.
Sorry, not his mother, yes.
Right.
But also, Sarah is frightened of Sid. In fact, when Sid throws a tantrum, she has to lock herself in a safe.
A gun safe, yeah. Yes.
So, yeah.
Well, that's, I think, considering what happens later in the movie, that's an appropriate response.
Yeah, seems to be.
Yeah, that's where I would be hiding.
Yeah. So, the next day, one of the Gatton men, boyfriend Jesse, played by Garrett Dillahunt, who we know is John Henry from Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Cro-Marty. I had a hard time because when I saw him, I'm like, oh, God. Like, I had so many conflicted emotions because he's so good. He's just so good in everything, so yeah. It's hard to see him. But then the whole fact that Joe and Sarah like humped it out, I'm like, oh God, please tell me there's not some like, you know, not some Michael Biehn Terminator offspring back from the future bullshit. So,
well, you know, that could have been a plot.
Well, see, that's what crept into my head. I'm like, oh God. So, but then I was like, Cro-Marty, as I go. Sarah Connor Chronicles. So if anybody doesn't know what we're talking about, Sarah Connor Chronicles. We talked about it in the pod earlier.
All of us really enjoyed it.
I'm trying to get boyfriend Jesse to watch it. I was trying to get him to rewatch or watch the movies with me, but he had a varying level of interest and or attention. So I don't know if he just wasn't ready or not. So we'll go back again though, because I absolutely intend to rewatch the Sarah Connor Chronicles because it was awesome. Yeah.
Well, again, sometimes it's more like big game fishing than it is. You can't force somebody to watch something like that. You have to kind of coax them in. Let them have a little line and then reel them back in slowly. And then let them run a little bit and reel them back in. Just kind of tire them out. So this is where we find out, where we get the hint that, oh yeah, Sid is probably the Rainmaker. They also drop some hints that he watched his mother be killed and he's got an artificial jaw. But that's all they know about him in the future. He's a recluse, a mystery man, a shadow, an enigma. That's all I got. yeah, so Cro-Marty gets fully reined.
In quite efficient dispatch.
Yes.
Again, practical effects. It was pretty amazing.
Oh, yeah. And so Sid, after killing this Gatman, runs off in the cornfield to weep it out. Joe finds him. They have a touching moment. And Joe thinks, or Sarah helps Joe think that this boy needs love, and therefore he may not turn into the Rainmaker if he's raised in a loving home.
Perhaps.
Meanwhile, Kid Blue has tracked old Joe to Susie's apartment, because one of the babies is actually Susie. So, theoretically, couldn't that baby also be Joe's baby?
Yes.
Yeah. So, Joe's theoretically going to have to shoot his own child as a five-year-old.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen because Kid Blue, who has some, he's a little bit of comic relief.
He's just kind of sad.
Yeah. I mean, kind of hapless.
Yeah. He's just a fuck up in general.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You feel bad for him, but then you also just want him to, you know, meet the business end of a wood chipper.
Yes. So, old Joe gets captured by Kid Blue, but old Joe then breaks free at Abe's place and manages to kill every single person. Except for Kid Blue, who he shoots in the foot. And ex-Kid Blue, there's a running joke because Kid Blue had shot himself in the other foot earlier, prior to the show. So, as the two Joes confront each other near Sarah's house, Kid Blue attacks and is killed by young Joe. And Sarah and Sid attempt to drive away, but old Joe starts shooting at their truck. So we have this final confrontation where we see Sid uses his TK powers to cause this truck to flip in a very spectacular way. And as they try to run and hide in the cane field, old Joe attempts to shoot them and a bullet grazes Sid's cheek. So this is a foreshadowing of this is where his jaw gets shot off and his mom gets killed. But then Sid has his final rage that we see in the movie, at least.
Yeah.
And basically, as old Joe and Sarah are being suspended in the air, along with all these other things in the field, and maybe going to be both turned into jam, Joe catches up, young Joe catches up, and as Sarah is trying to calm down Sid to get him to basically stop his tantrum and not squish everybody with his TK powers, Sid finally does, and so Sarah and old Joe drop to the ground again, but old Joe is still intent on killing the kid. So young Joe is close enough to see this all happening, but not close enough to do anything directly about it. Until he's telling the story, he foresees the future where old Joe kills his mom, Sid runs off and escapes, but is embittered and becomes the Rainmaker. So I don't know about you, but I was thinking, even watching this time, not remembering how it ended originally, I thought young Joe was going to like shoot his own hand off, maybe, so that old Joe couldn't fire the gun. But no, young Joe actually does something even more dramatic, maybe noble, and he just shoots himself in the chest. Because that way he can effectively close all the timelines. He takes himself out at this time, so there is no old Joe. So Sid can grow up reasonably loved, and therefore no Rainmaker. But it actually doesn't even matter as far as the Rainmaker part of it, because Joe's not around, and therefore will not find the love of his life in Shanghai, and she will then not be killed by the Rainmaker.
So, mission accomplished.
Yeah, it's a very, appropriate, big climatic ending, like, big,
the crescendo.
Yeah, it's a very dramatic ending.
Yeah.
So,
well, I also like the fact that they gave Sarah TK powers as well, and that's what she actually ended up using to get through to Sid when he had her suspended, because she was basically astral projecting to calm him down.
It's a little Carrie. It's a little it's, Damien.
Yeah.
But really it's a hero's journey, and Joe becomes a fallen hero.
I was going to say, I don't know if it's a hero's journey. It's that's a stretch, but.
Well, and at the end she walks over and, strokes his hair, something that he told Susie that his own mother used to do for him. So it's like a little visual callback to an earlier scene in the movie. Yeah. So, any other notes on Looper?
I said that at the beginning of the movie, Joe has that French Stewart squint.
Yes, he does.
Which is funny because, you know, they have Joseph Gordon-Levitt and French Stewart have a connection in Third Rock.
Third Rock, so, the sun, yeah.
Some of the added features. Emily Blunt didn't realize that it was Joseph Gordon-Levitt when she saw him in one of the trailers. She thought that it was just one of the stuntmen of the makeup, you know, with makeup. She didn't realize it was actually him underneath all that. So she was actually mightily impressed. This is all kind of deleted scenes. When Bruce Willis meets his future mate wife, when he meets her and tries to entice her, she flips him off. And there is so much in that middle finger that was a really well acted scene, I thought.
Oh yeah,
on her part. So without having any dialogue, she really kind of transcended.
There's a lot of like what we would consider like auteur filmmaker bullshit. But it's really well handled, I thought. Like, there are some strange angles. There are some, like slow motion or, you know, shots that dissolve from one to the other. But I thought it was a pretty cleverly handled, very deft, not quite in your face like a Sean Penn directed thing.
So I had a hard time. Some of this was very much like Signs. There were some parallels. The laundry room scene, there was a deleted scene. Where Sid and young Joe go down to the basement, and that's when the door didn't quite close. So Cromarty and Sarah go down the stairs, and there's this big scene about, it's actually quite funny. It was a funny scene, for the most part, about, you know, he's looking around all the stuff in the basement. Like the washer and the dryer, and there's like a clothes rack that's all zipped up, and he's going to shoot at it. And he's like, I'm just going to shoot at it. You better get him out, call him out. And she's like, she rolls her eyes and she's like, opens it up. And she's like, nobody in there. And she opens the washer and says, nobody in there. Opens the dryer, nobody in there. And she goes, you know what? Why don't I go upstairs and show you my shoe rack? And then you can get the fuck out of my house. Hmm. Which is, of course, they crawled out of the grate underneath the washer and dryer to that little tunnel that got dug out by. But my point, though, is they were coming out of that little tunnel. Why wouldn't they have gone back into the house rather than destroying their tunnel exit?
You think, yeah.
That was kind of a stupid thing. But other than that, that was all of my notes right there.
Yeah. So what did Boyfriend Desi like this?
I'm not sure. I didn't get a straight answer.
So he wasn't raving about how good it was.
Mm-mm.
Well, that says something. So
what? I mean, I don't think he hated it. I didn't hate it either. I would give this is probably a B movie. It's a strong, solid B. It's not an A movie to me by any stretch. But it, you know, like I think I paid $5 or $6 for it. And I was, you know, that's fine. It was worth it. I own it now. So, you know, it is what it is. It's not a bad movie. So.
Yeah, it's not available streaming anywhere. So I bought it too. I bought the last copy in Anchorage at the Barnes & Noble, a bookstore of all things. Pretty soon we're only going to be able to talk about streaming movies because we won't be able to buy physical movies anymore. It's coming. At least on the main markets.
Well, I'm surprised you can still get just regular DVDs.
Oh, exactly, yeah.
So, that's gonna be the first thing that will go.
Yeah, but once Blu-rays become less expensive, that would help. Like, is there a manufacturing reason why they should be so expensive?
Blu-rays?
Yes.
No, not really. I mean, you're paying for faster devices because, you know, you have to... There's more data, so... If you want to sell as many Blu-ray DVDs, you have to have a machine that can burn faster than you can a standard because you're basically getting anywhere from 18 to 60 gigs on a Blu-ray versus the 6 or 7 gigs on a...
So it's a time consideration that makes it more expensive to produce.
Well, it's not necessarily time. It's that you have to get a faster, more expensive burner so that you can keep up to speed. So, you know, you can get a cheap burner, you know, you can get a cheap 24 by DVD burner that will, you know, burn you a DVD in, you know, 20 minutes. But if you're burning a Blu-ray at the same speed, it's going to take you a couple of hours. So you have to then get an exponentially faster, or I should say not exponentially, but you have to get, on an order of faster machine to be able to keep the same output. So it's a production thing. I'm sure that, just like buying a Blu-ray drive versus a DVD drive is also expensive. So it's a technology thing.
Yeah, interesting.
But again, every generation that gets cheaper and cheaper. And my external Blu-ray writer was under $100, and it's portable. You know, it's completely self-contained. Tiny.
No, I think I told you the new desktop I bought is technically a gaming desktop. So it's got a DVD drive, but it's cheap because these days gamers stream everything. They download and stream. When you buy a big expensive game, often you don't have a disc. You just have a code for Steam, and then you can download all the content from them.
Yeah, it depends. I'll buy some Xbox games with a code, but I almost prefer to have them as the media.
Oh yeah.
Although Microsoft has gotten better about, it used to be you had to have the disc. And if you downloaded it, you always ran the risk that if you didn't have it anymore, it was a big hassle to get it back. And now part of Microsoft's standard package maintenance, as far as their Xbox Live business, once you own it, you own it. It's in your library. You can delete it and download it again at any time. The only catch is that, you're bound to Microsoft servers. So if their servers are down, or if they're slow, or God forbid someday they decide not to have the title there anymore, then you're screwed. But I don't see that necessarily happening.
It's kind of like Audible. Like technically, once you buy a book on Audible, you own the rights to download that book forever.
Right.
As long as it's available through Audible.
Right.
Yeah. And technically, you can download the files, because way back in the beginning of my Audible days, I did that. Me too. Because I didn't have an iPod.
Right. Me too. I did the same thing, because I would download it and then burn it to a CD.
Oh, yeah. I did
that. Or mini CDs.
Yeah, exactly. Like 10 CDs or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Those were the days.
Yeah, they were. But let me tell you, you really appreciated an audiobook when you had to actually buy cassettes or CDs. Because they were expensive. So, Looper, I would say this is a B+ for me. I guess it doesn't really rise to the level of an A-, but it's a pretty solid movie, I thought. I thought the little acting touches they did, I thought there was plenty of humor, which is nice. I thought Jeff Daniels was great. I love Jeff Daniels.
Jeff Bridges would have been okay in this role too.
Yeah, yeah.
He would have been just playing the Big Lebowski though.
Yeah, or Kurt Russell could play that character. Old Kurt Russell. Well, maybe not. I don't know. Kurt Russell's his own thing. We have to do a Kurt Russell run at some point. Actually, we just need to do Stargate. Because that's a French Stewart movie. It's also...
Isn't that James Spader?
Uh-huh.
Yep. I recall liking Stargate.
It's got things.
Yeah.
I watched it relatively recently, and it's got some really fun things. But it's got some other things.
It's got some issues.
It's got the guy from The Crying Game, I think. Which is also on the list. And a movie I haven't seen in a very long time. But yeah, so I thought Looper was fine, a fine end to Clocktober.
Yeah.
Now, next week, we return all together for Inception, which I have never seen.
I'm surprised by that. Of course, admittedly, I didn't see it until it's only been 4 or 5 years, I think. So.
Yeah. So hopefully it will be enjoyable. And we don't have a special month for November, but it was fun to do Cliptember and Clocktober.
Yeah. I think our next theme is either Christmas. Well, are you doing, Halloween. So,
do we have Christmas movies on the list yet? We probably don't. We probably need to throw some on there.
I don't know that we have a lot of Christmas movies left.
Oh, we do. We need to see Go, which we talked about that how.
I don't know anything about Go, so.
Have you never seen Go?
Mm-mm.
Okay, well, I will adjust the calendar so that we get to talk about Go. But here, I have actually a list of Christmas movies still left for us to do. Hold on. Christmas movies. Actually, we only have three. There is Go, Enemy of the State, and The Ref.
Enemy of the State? Is that Gene Hackman and Will Smith?
Yeah. It's for some reason it's on my Christmas movies list.
I've never seen it.
Oh, you've never seen it?
I've seen parts of it. I've never seen the movie itself.
I remember it being very cool at the time because it was our first like satellite imagery thing and it was all like whiz-bang science fiction sort of stuff. It'd be interesting to see what happens in the light of day in 2018. Light of day? What was that? It'd be interesting to see what it looks like in 2018 where some of this stuff is reality, where you are monitored by the government on a lot of what you do. So, you want me to try to shoehorn those into the calendar for Christmas?
Sure.
Yeah, okay. That'd be fun. Okay. I will make sure I have all of those movies. I know I have two of them. I don't know if I have The Ref or not. But The Ref is where I first saw Kevin Spacey. Yeah, so on to housekeeping.
The Cinematic Church of Horror is a cathartic and challenging sanctum for its congregation. In this timeless chamber, the wind of cultural history whispers through stone walls, decorated with the iconography of symbolic and supernatural power. This is a spiritual screen chosen by an audience who willingly seek confrontation with death, supernatural forces, and the primal fear of the unknown. Due for release in early 2019, House of Leaves Publishing presents a collection of writings exploring the cultural history of religion in horror cinema. Scared Sacred, Idolatry, Religion, and Worship in the Horror Film is edited by Rebecca Booth, author of The Devil Rides Out, part of the Devil's Advocate series from Mature Publishing, Aaron Thompson, owner and editor of the Backseat Driver Reviews, and R.F. Todd, managing director of House of Leaves. The book developed in response to the recent reclaiming of the fusion between supernatural and religious themes in mainstream horror cinema and brings together leading critics, historians, and writers in the horror community to tackle this theological topography. In addition to an introduction by author and theologian Professor Douglas E. Cohen, the book also features a foreword from actor and author Doug Bradley, who brought to life perhaps the most iconic figure in religious horror cinema. Thematically, the book is divided into four sections to provide a well-rounded analysis of world religion, idolatry, and worship, covering a diverse range of subjects, from atheism to auditory hallucination, martyrdom to medieval witch, and zealotry to zealotry. The outpouring of support and interest in Scared Sacred has been heartwarming, and we hope you enjoy the book. Thank you so much for joining us on this journey. We couldn't have picked better company.
Housekeeping.
Do we have any You're Not Alone mental health stories to tell people they're not alone? I don't. I'm just
I do not have any mental health stories this week, no.
Actually, I've got a quick thing. So today I taught a class of recruits, and there were three of them. And I think I told you before, I consider myself 35, even though I am 49.
Yeah.
So it doesn't occur to me that people that are much younger really are much younger. But this, I was actually told a couple days ago, just so you know, one of the people is kind of young, so... And, you know, they're all, like, at least, like, under 35. So, your movie references may not hit home. I'm like, oh, I know. The one thing I use is I use a reference to the movie Roadhouse, which I figured everybody's seen Roadhouse.
No.
I was 0 for 3 today. And one of the ladies, she was born after I started working at my job. So suddenly yeah. I'm like Grandpa Eric telling stories. So, oh well, I will adjust to this role as I have adjusted to others. Anyway, so yeah, I think that's my only housekeeping really.
I've started to hire employees that were born after I graduated high school.
Oh yeah. No, let me tell you. This girl was born after Drew graduated college.
Yeah, so I feel you.
It's a crazy world. Okay, sorry. I interrupted your housekeeping. You have any housekeeping?
I do. We've been watching, we stumbled across Netflix, the Netflix food series, which is Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, which is 4 episodes. I highly recommend it.
So are they divided into Salt, Fat, Acid, and Heat, the episodes?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay. Cool. Who's the host, or who, is it like a documentary or?
Yeah, it's her. See, I just forgot her name. Simin
Paula Poundstone.
Simin Nosrat.
Oh,
she's sure. Iranian. She American chef and food writer. She's a food columnist for New York Times Magazine.
Oh,
the Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat was really, really kind of fascinating and interesting. So, it's just 4 episodes, but it. You know, each episode is one of those elements. So it was kind of an interesting, it just said some interesting things that I hadn't expected to see. So,
So highly recommend it. Did you learn about food, or did you learn about the history of cuisine, or what does it teach you?
It's more about how each of those things tie together to create the food that you eat and how important each of those is on their own. History, not necessarily. That's kind of, there's some history there, but more of it is just kind of an explanation, you know, about how salt is used and how salt is important and different kinds of salt and, you know, what salt really, you know, we use different ingredients that actually are salty, but aren't necessarily salt itself, you know, anchovies and things of that nature. Hmm. So food has all
soy
kinds
sauce.
Of... Exactly. So it was just kind of fascinating. We watched it a couple nights ago because I didn't know what to watch. And I'm like, let's just watch this. It looks interesting. And then we watched the whole episode. And we're like, wow, that's really cool. And I always know it's good when the boys are like, let's watch the next one. I'm like, no. There's 3 left. Well, you don't need to burn through it. So, other than that, not much going on my end. Just I voted, so
excellent. Good for
vote
you.
Vote by mail.
So back to food for just a second. Did you see that they are they're like doing a reboot of Good Eats?
Yes, I saw that Alton Brown is.
Yeah, it's interesting how they kind of go through and reminisce about old episodes and change things that he does differently now, or he's learned different ways of doing.
Yeah. And in his defense, he's altered some of his recipes from the past before now, but now he's just doing it in video form.
Yeah.
Because he made a big thing about how he's changed his stance on pasta, how you cook pasta, how you boil pasta.
Hold on. What was his original stance?
You need a nice giant pot with a ton of water and... Put some salt in the water and you boil it until it's al dente, and that's good.
What's his new stance?
You barely put just enough water in the pot to cover the pasta so that it can boil.
Like in a frying pan, for instance?
Yes, or a very small saucepan. Because it brings it up to temperature faster, cooks it more efficiently, and you're not wasting a bunch of water. You get a more concentrated... starch water, which that pasta starch water is used to thicken sauces. So if you're making spaghetti and you have that pasta, that starch water is very, very helpful in thickening up your spaghetti sauce or things of that nature.
Interesting. Yeah. See, that kind of stuff is, I find fascinating. Like I realized seeing, because I think it's the Cooking Channel, which is like a sister station of the Food Channel, has these episodes, and I had forgotten how good Eats really is. Like, explaining the science behind the cooking, to me, was a real eye-opener.
That was the great thing about Good Eats, is that it wasn't just a straight cooking show. You got a lot out of the cooking, but the reason that it stuck with me is because there was so much science in it that it immediately ended up in my brain. Because I was very receptive to that. So it wasn't like watching a cooking show where I'm like, I'm never going to remember this. Because he would teach the basics of what he was doing. And so the software or ingredients were just incidental. The process is what was important.
Well, and also technique. He taught technique in a way that was really easy. It's kind of, it was like sneaky learning.
Right.
So, yeah, really, really well done show. So I'm happy to see it in reboot fashion. They have also rebooted the original Iron Chef. And it turns out the original Iron Chef.
In America or abroad?
The original abroad one. They've picked new chefs. They kind of show sometimes the old chefs because, you know, so it was Chinese cuisine and French cuisine were the three Iron Chefs. Yeah. The ones that are still alive they show up kind of as judges, but there's a huge judging panel. And, you know, the original reason why it was popular is because of the crazy dubbing.
Yes. Well, and, it wasn't crazy dubbing, like made up dubbing. It was just crazy. They picked an exuberant translation.
Yes. And every ooh and ah. Yes. Was done in dubbing, so it's really over the top.
There's a different example of dubbing that's awesome, which is MXC, Most Extreme Elimination Challenge.
Oh, jeez.
Which is based off of Takeshi's Castle, which is a Japanese game show, I believe. Mm. But at the time, it was like the Spike Network, Spike TV.
Yes.
Bought the rights to it in America and then overdubbed it for complete comedic purpose in English.
Yes.
Nonsensically. And so it is like 12-year-old humor and it is juvenile and I laugh every time. I have it on DVD. I have all four seasons, I think, on DVD. And it is gold. It is genius. So.
Is it streaming any place that I can find an example of it?
I'll look if I can.
YouTube or something?
Yeah, I'll find you some clips because it is...
Okay.
It's... Because they've got like, you know, one of the hosts is like Captain Tennille. And then there's like Guy Ledoux. And there's all kinds of stuff like that. So, it's juvenile and stupid, but some of it is just so hilarious because they go to great lengths to really lay like the groundwork for a long running gag.
Oh, yes. I like
that. So throughout the whole thing, you're just building on this gag and sometimes you get it and I know that there was people that watched the show and never got it.
Oh,
they're just like, you know, like, I don't know why this is funny.
Again, it's like rat race. Oh, God.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like rat race. If you're paying attention when the big jokes hit, they hit hard. It's pretty great. And you realize how long it took to craft that joke. I mean, it's really, for dumb humor, it's really writerly stuff.
Yeah. The longest running Hitler joke ever.
Exactly. Yeah. And for that punchline to go all that way, it's so funny to me.
Yeah.
It's like you laugh and you also tip your hat.
Well, I think we discussed with Rat Race that first time I saw it, I was crying at the Hitler joke. I mean, not that Hitler's funny, but the John Lovitz thing, I was crying. I laughed myself sick. The first time. I love that movie. So I recommend it to people, but I also warn them, like, if you're not in the right mood, don't watch it because you have to be in the right mood.
Yeah.
At least I think.
Well, but, and you know, again, humor is one of those things that doesn't hit everybody the same way.
Yeah. Well, that's why those American Pie movies are so popular.
Well, I have the option today because, you know, my rule for new people is to tell them, look, there are circumstances in which you can be really assertive in getting information from a caller, but you have to realize that they're actually a customer. And so you need to treat them like a customer. And the rule is, it's the Roadhouse rules. It's be nice until it's time to not be nice. But if you haven't seen the movie, Even if I played a clip, I have the ability to play the clip of that movie, but basically all the clip would be is people smoking and swearing and then be nice till it's not time. So I'm just say, just be nice until it's time to not be nice. And then I like, give them examples in real world examples. So
they never did get to the remake of that. So,
yeah, well, it's probably best, I think.
Yeah.
A lot of remakes are, it's not necessary really.
Yeah.
Do I have this actually? Sways. I've watched a lot of movies this last week.
did you?
Yeah, I still use Letterboxd, so let me pull up my Letterboxd movies for this week. Okay, so in the last week, I watched like a French language movie, or no, maybe it was a German language movie called "We Are the Night." And it's kind of about like, it was German because it was taking place in Berlin. It's about like modern vampires, sort of. But they're all ladies and they're all, it's all like a strange, like vampire fantasy where they drive expensive cars and go shopping after hours, expensive places and blah, blah, blah. But I didn't have a copy that had a dub or a subtitle. So I actually watched it in German. And because it's a vampire movie that's, like, flashy, it was fine. Not great, but it was fine.
You got the gist of it.
Yep. I watched a horrible teen movie called The Witch Files. I rewatched Rob Zombie's movie 31, which is not great, but for some reason I love Richard Brake, so he was great in it. I watched Hotel Artemis, which was kind of panned. It's the futuristic movie starring... Jodie Foster, sort of a post-apocalyptic Jodie Foster movie. It's kind of violent, but really fun.
Oh, right. I remember I saw a preview for that and then dismissed it completely.
Nope. 4 stars. Highly recommended.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I watched a...
She plays like a nurse, right?
Yes.
All right.
I watched a French horror movie called The Most Assassinated Woman in the World.
Oh, dear.
It's actually a period piece. Talks about the Grand Guignol Theater. It's okay. I gave it 3.5. I watched the movie Truth or Dare, which I gave 2.5. Crap.
Truth or Dare, not the Madonna movie.
No, this is a horror movie.
Oh, okay.
Where, like, teens or college students have to recreate this game of truth. It's stupid.
You lost me at teens.
It's dumb.
Go figure. Yeah.
I watched Apostle, which is actually really good. It's on Netflix. I'm not going to tell you too much about it, except that I thought the acting is really good. It stars Michael Sheen.
Oh.
Who is great.
I like Michael Sheen.
Yep. Everybody else is fairly unrecognizable, but everybody does a good job. I recommend it. Apostle, it's called. Let's see. Then I watched the movie The Devil's Candy, which is, I thought, really interesting. It's a horror movie. It's about the tag thing is a struggling painter is possessed by satanic forces after he and his young family moved to their dream home in rural Texas. That's really simplifying what happens. It actually moves along a little more organically than that. But I thought it was visually pretty stunning. So I gave it 3.5 for a horror movie. I watched the worst movie in the Halloween series. And there are some contenders, by the way, for the worst movies in the Halloween series. I think there's been 9 of them or 11 of them so far. I have not seen the most recent movie that's in the theaters, but I bought the novelization on Audible, so that'll be interesting. But I watched Halloween Resurrection. And have you seen any of the Halloween movies?
No.
You're not a slasher movie guy.
No.
Well, so H2O is when when Jamie Lee Curtis returned. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I interrupted.
No, I was just going to say, I've seen parts of them enough tangentially around you and Brother Drew that I knew that they were just not for me.
Yeah. No, I agree. They're probably not for you.
Yeah. So it isn't that I don't like to be scared. So slasher movies and I have a tenuous relationship at best with suspense movies because I like them, but they scare the shit out of me. And then I have bad dreams for weeks. So That's why I tend not to want horror or slasher films, because it stays in my head far longer than I would care for it to. So
yeah. Well, this one is dumb. it's okay. It has Jamie Lee Curtis, who reprises her role from the original Halloween movie and Halloween 2 and Halloween H2O. But this time there's a reality show element. Jamie Lee Curtis is only in it for a bit. I think she was contractually obligated to do it, so she's in just a little bit in the beginning. She knew the script was crap. So the rest of the movie is about a reality show where Michael Myers shows up and starts killing people. And the reality show, the host is Busta Rhymes. The producer is Tyra Banks.
Oh, jeez.
We've got Sean Patrick Thomas. We have Katie Sackhoff, who played Starbuck in the most recent. She's good. She's fine.
BSG.
But yeah, bad. The movie is so bad. It's just ridiculous. It's the worst ever. So, you know, in my horror movies up to Halloween, that's a pretty bad one. So yeah, so for me, that's quite a run. And then, of course, last week I watched both Unsane and The Girl on the Train, which The Girl on the Train is a pretty great Emily Blunt movie. I gave that 4 stars too. So I recommend that.
Boyfriend Jesse is querying to see if you have seen and or like either The Conjuring 2 or Evil Dead.
The new Evil Dead? Yes, I've seen both of them. I remember liking both of them, but I think I liked the Evil Dead remake better.
Gotcha. I'll make sure he listens.
Yeah. Yes. Yes to both.
Okay. Speaking of Michael Sheen, you know, Michael Sheen's going to be in Good Omens.
Oh, yeah. Who's the other one? Who's the other? He must. Does he play the devil?
Aziraphale.
Okay. And that's the bad guy? The good guy?
That's the good guy. Aziraphale's the good guy.
So who's the bad guy is?
Crowley, David Tennant.
Oh. Okay, David Tennant. There you go. So I know it was somebody whose name I recognized.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Somebody. It's somebody pretty big stars. Just watching the previews, which I have watched shamefully more times than I would actually admit. I don't know. I'm really hopeful because it's going to be many episodes, so they're not just going to cram it all into like one or two shows.
Is it an English production or British production?
Yes.
Which is good, because the book had so many British references that I didn't understand when I first read it. Only later did I... kind of like the Douglas Adams books has some jokes in there that I didn't get, because they reference, like, UK... Like, the whole... Like, in Hitchhiker's Guide, the fact that the guy was named... The hitchhiker was named Ford Prefect, like, didn't... I didn't even understand why that was funny. But that's because the model, like, the Ford... Motor company made a model called the Prefect, which is pretty ubiquitous at the time. So the idea is this guy comes to Earth and he picks a name.
He's just generic.
Because it's a very common name, yeah. So it'd be like if he showed up and referred to himself as Chevy Malibu.
Jesus, I can only imagine.
So there's lots of jokes like that I didn't get.
Yeah. Now, this is, so it's an Amazon Studios, but it's in conjunction with BBC.
Sweet.
So I think it's kind of the best of both worlds, because I think that means they'll release it all at the same time.
Does Neil Gaiman have any hand in it? Didn't Terry Pratchett die, or am I thinking of somebody else?
I think he did, but I could be wrong. Yeah, he died in 2015. Terry Pratchett did.
Yeah, so Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman co-wrote Good Omens.
Yes.
And so for me, Good Omens is hilarious.
The audiobook is awesome, by the way.
How does it deal with footnotes? Because the best thing about the books was there were footnotes on every page, and some pages were more footnotes than text.
I'm not knowing what was footnote and what wasn't, I couldn't tell you, but I can tell you that it was, it was really awesome. So
yeah, I will have to, I think I actually own it on Audible, but I haven't listened to it. But yeah, it was one of my favorite books back when I was reading books.
Yeah, I guess it's going to be 7 episodes. So, and they're going to be 60-minute episodes-ish. So, you know, 7 hours of TV. I think that's perfect. Probably a good...
Yeah, that's a True Detective kind of length.
Yeah.
Great. Actually, it's just a British series length. Like, that's just standard. Like, to do a series being, like, 6 or 8 episodes, and then that's where the story ends. And if you get another series of the same thing, great. But you don't have to.
Yeah. Maybe it's 6 episodes. They're saying 7, but I only see 6. But none of them are named, of course. But, no, it looks so good. And I'm just hoping they don't fuck it up.
Well, there's a chance.
Yeah, but I'm trying not to get too excited. But.
So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here.
One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies, so they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the Brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey!